Some preachers joke about preaching a series of sermons called Bible Passages Too Hot to Handle. It would tackle all those perplexing and embarrassing lines scattered through the Bible that we always skip over, you know, like the ones where the Apostle Paul says that he wishes that the proponents of circumcision for all would accidentally slip and knacker themselves. I've never heard anybody preach on that for some reason. A friend of mine who's an excellent songwriter used to joke about writing a new volume of scripture in song to cover all those same problem verses. And he penned classics which don't seem to be quite gaining broad acceptance, like Bring Me the Foreskins of 10,000 Philistines. And one that we almost heard tonight, Dashing Babies on the Rocks. We didn't hear that line tonight because it's deemed too ugly to be heard in Christian worship, so the lectionary cuts the psalm short. It's just one verse short. I don't very often preach on the psalm, and even less often on the missing verses, but that's where I'm going tonight. Psalm 137 is frequently sung both in churches and sometimes in mainstream music. Some of us are old enough to remember the classic disco hit by Boney M, which came out when I was 14. That version actually came from a Jamaican reggae band called the Melodians in 1970. I'm not quite old enough to have picked up on Jamaican reggae music by that stage. By the rivers of Babylon, where we sat down, yes, we wept when we remembered Zion. They carried us away in captivity, requiring of us a song. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? I can also remember singing another version of it in church youth group in a round, but I'm pretty sure that the last couple of verses never made it into any of the songs. They had to all be cleaned up and sanitised. Because those final verses say, O Babylon, you devastator, blessed be those who pay you back for what you have done to us. Blessed are those who take your babies and dash them against the rocks. Often Christians find it very difficult to properly express grief and hurt with our all too frequent obsession with happy, victorious living. But we cope better with the expression of grief than we do with the expression of naked rage and lust for vengeance. This psalm begins with grief, mourning, and painful memory, but it ends in screaming, head-smashing rage. What are we to do with that? How do we reconcile a view of ourselves as a Bible-loving people with the fact that it contains lines in which somebody wishes to see Babylonian babies bashed to death against the rocks? Any way you look at it, it is an ugly, vindictive, and barbaric statement. It's the sort of thing that caused Gilbert's hero, John Wesley, to say that there are some psalms which are unfit for Christian ears. Christian people aren't supposed to talk like that. We're supposed to be people of patient endurance. Turn the other cheek. Love your enemies and all that. Excuse me. So what do we do with this psalm and its last verse? Well, let me give it a context for starters. This is one of the few psalms that clearly states its own historical context. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept as we remembered Jerusalem. It comes from the community of Jewish people marched off into exile in Babylon after the destruction of Jerusalem in 587 BCE. It brings us the feelings and needs of a people who had been forcibly removed from their homelands under the Babylonian imperial policy of compulsory relocation. A people who are clinging to their memories and their hope for an eventual homecoming. The first three verses give us the picture. A people mourning what they've lost, weeping by the river, and hanging up their musical instruments, unable to sing. Their misery was exacerbated by their overlords forcing them to sing the Zion songs as entertainment. In the same way that many of the songs of Australia's Indigenous people cannot be sung except in secret ceremonies, so too these Zion songs were sacred songs, and to sing them as mere entertainment for people who did not share in their hope was considered pornographic. The forced singing was intended to humiliate an already destitute people. During the Second World War, the exact same thing happened in the death camp at Treblinka. Jews were again forced by their captors to sing and dance their sacred songs as a way of stripping them of their identity, their dignity, and their hope. In the middle of the psalm, it begins to move beyond grieving into stubborn resistance. We can't and we won't sing the Lord's songs in this place. May my hands wither if I fail to keep the memory of Jerusalem holy. May my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I defile these memories. There's a tenacious defiance in these words, a refusal to be budged, and a determination to hold on to the hope of a better future. You can do to me as you wish, but I will not betray the vision of God's holy city. Ancient Jewish faith, again, has remarkable similarities to Australian Indigenous spirituality in terms of the connection to particular pieces of land, things that can only happen in certain places, things that can only be sung in certain places. The songs cannot be sung in the wrong place. And the hope centres on returning to the right place, the sacred place. Faith refuses to acknowledge that the military power of the day controls all of life. A defiant counter-attitude says that God still rules and that Babylon will meet its end. And then the psalm begins to move into the problematic last few verses. It calls on God to hold a grudge against those who ordered the destruction of Jerusalem. And it calls blessings upon those who do unto Babylon as Babylon has done unto Israel. And most horrifyingly, upon those who smash Babylonian babies against the rocks. There's nothing noble or romantic about this prayer. It is hissing, spitting, blood-curdling rage. An ugly, naked lust for vengeance that makes your flesh crawl. No wonder all the songs end at verse 6. My songwriting friend's new scripture chorus is not going to catch on. I don't think that I have ever, even for a moment, wanted to see anyone's baby smashed to death on a rock. But then again, I've never had my children led to get the gas chambers. I've somehow learned to accommodate my comfortable lifestyle to the knowledge that many of my brothers and sisters can't get enough food for their children. I've never been a frightened child locked in a car outside a casino. And I was never forced to perform sexual favours for my adult relatives. I don't actually have any right to stand in judgment of such a sense of rage in such circumstances. Some of us are old enough to remember Gough Whitlam calling for Australians to maintain their rage in 1975. In a way, that's what this psalm is, a call to maintain the rage. Notice that there's actually no suggestion that the original people of the psalm actually took action against anybody's babies, or even that they would have if they could have. Despite the ugliness of the call for vengeance, the prayer still leaves that vengeance to God. It doesn't say, we're going to do this. It says, God, bless anyone who does. It's still left in God's hands. Stark and vivid imagery is used to energise the defiance of the community. The call to remember the joys of home will not have as lasting power if they're not held with the passionate anger about the crimes being committed now. At a psychological level, this rage is important too. We've all heard it said that when anger is suppressed, it poisons us slowly, usually turning into depression and draining the life out of us. There's nothing suppressed about the anger in this psalm. This vile, cursing rage is brought to the altar of God to be publicly processed, to be vented and given expression, to be worked through and offered to God for transformation into creative energy. God would much rather listen to the honest pain and rage in our hearts than to the pious pretense of our sanitized niceness. So it's ugly and awkward, but I'm ultimately glad that these words are in the Bible. Because if we edit out these kind of words, we edit out all the hurt and anger of the abused peoples of this world. We edit out the people who are forcibly removed from their lands to make way for coffee plantations and beef paddocks. We edit out the thousands of babies in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Baghdad that our side of the wars felt quite able to incinerate. We edit out the anger and despair of those locked up without hope in our immigration detention centres. We edit out the sexually exploited women and children, the homeless, the refugees. Where will they go to express their hurt and their rage if we edit it right out of our Bibles, out of our faith, out of our consciousness? We are followers of Jesus, and we are called to maintain the rage. Like the Jews in exile before us, we are a people whose first allegiance is to a world in which we do not yet live. Our first allegiance is to the new creation, the new world, the new Jerusalem. We are citizens of a world where there will be no crying and no pain, a world where the lion will lie down with the lamb, in which people will build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their produce. A world in which people will not have to spend years on waiting lists before they can get decent housing. A world in which the economists and the journalists value the life of a Sudanese or Syrian child the same as a new royal baby. A world in which schools get all the money they need and the Grand Prix Corporation has to run cake stalls. A world in which people will feel so thankful and fulfilled in their lives that the casino will be converted to a concert venue. But until that vision is fulfilled, we are a people in exile, a people who mourn for what should be but isn't, a people who refuse to cooperate with the overlords and the opinion makers and the vested interests of the present order. A people who would rather have their tongues stick to the roof of their mouths than sanction the actions of those who measure life in dollars and culture in investment potential. We are a people who are enraged by the injustice and hostility and humiliation of this world and who will not be silenced until it is overcome. We hold on to the vision of Jerusalem, the vision of life in all its fullness for everybody, regardless of age, race, religion, capability, sexual identity, or immigration status. And we strive to see it fulfilled. As a people who hold that vision of the life that God has given us and called us to live to the full, we will continue to pour out vile curses whenever that life is opposed or degraded or demeaned. Those who can no longer curse what destroys life are those who no longer care. I'm not contradicting Jesus' call to love our enemies. I'm saying that our first call is to love life and to create a world in which enemies can become friends. We love our enemies by treating them with the same justice and compassion that we are seeking for everybody else, not by acquiescing to their poisonous and destructive ways. In a Holocaust museum in Israel, there is a shirt that is made from a Torah scroll. It is a shirt which a Nazi SS officer forced an unknown Jewish tailor to make, thinking that it would be a huge joke among his Nazi mates to have a shirt made from the vellum pages of a Hebrew Bible. But the joke was on him, literally. The tailor, who knew Hebrew, made the shirt entirely from pages of Deuteronomy 28. You can look it up later if you wish, but basically it is a series of vile, rage-filled and wonderfully healthy curses. And long may it be so.